Here is one of a series of talks by spiritual leader Lola McDowell Lee, spanning two decades from the early 70s through the 90s. Lola was a Zen Roshi whose Rinzai lineage included Dr. Henry Plutov and renowned Zen master Shigetsu Sasaki. Lola was a religious scholar as well as an ordained Christian minister. While the talks are focused mainly on Zen and Buddhism, Lola drew on many spiritual traditions, including those of Jesus, Plato, Lao Tzu, the Hindu Vedas, Meister Eckhart, and Gurdjieff.
Well, we're continuing from last week, and we are on chapter 15 of the Tao Te Ching of Lao Tzu. The skillful masters of the Tao in olden times, with a subtle and exquisite penetration, comprehended its mysteries, which were so deep that they eluded man's knowledge. Those of yore who have succeeded in becoming masters are subtle, spiritual, profound, and penetrating. On account of their profundity, they cannot be understood. Because they cannot be understood, therefore I endeavor to make them intelligible. How cautious they are. Like a man in winter crossing a river. How reluctant. Like men fearing in the four quarters their neighbors. How reserved. They behave like guests. How elusive. They resemble ice when melting. How simple. They resemble rough wood. How empty, they resemble the valley. How obscure, they resemble muddy water. How by quieting can gradually render muddy waters clear? Who by stirring can gradually quicken the still? Well, we know, I think we know, that men and women, men generically, you know, so men and mankind, all over the world have ideas and notions of what a saint should be like. And this is what some of this we talked about last week. Last week was storytelling time. Now you must remember the stories. This goes with them. Now, instead of ideas, Lao Tzu stresses awareness. To be alert, to be aware. Now, the patterns of our lives, as a general rule, are not very sensitive. I mean, you take the average family, and they have children, and do the parents look at these children and say, I mean, I wonder how often they do this. How best can I show this little human being how to deal with the world? How can I best teach him to cope with himself in the world? Maybe what I do is not the best for him. Okay for me, but maybe not for him. Do they study the child? Do they watch him? Do they observe him to see what his tendencies are? Maybe there's some changes should be made in the way this family lives. Now, I don't know of too many households that think this way. Usually, it's pretty cut and dry. He just added on a little appendage, little toe sticking out here, you know, to the family as such. You know, and if he's born into a non-vegetarian family, he eats meat. And he's born into a vegetarian family, he doesn't eat meat. And this vegetarian, if you set meat in front of him, it makes him sick, literally. And he thinks he is very spiritual because of this. You know, meat is, which is, you know, is a notion. Because, you know, if God is all in all, or if all is the Buddha nature, then meat must be of God also. Yeah. But of course, if meat disagrees with you and you can't eat it, that's one thing. But the child should be allowed to choose. I know of a family where the child was born into a family of meat eaters and he didn't want to eat. I mean, he refused until I was about 7 years old, going on 8 or something like that, and Santa Claus came one night and stood in the doorway, you know, and hollered at these two little boys that were sitting there on the floor, you know, at Christmas time, and asked them if they'd been good. Ho, 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 you know, you've been good little boys. And, oh, yeah, oh, yeah. Well, you haven't been eating meat. I'll eat Farmer John's from now on. I'll eat Farmer John's from now on. You know. But, you know, you know, our conditioning is such. The child in the family is just automatically supposed to take on our conditioning and carry it further. Now, Lao Tzu, this wise old Chinese man, he doesn't think much of this matter of what you eat and what you drink, or what you don't eat and what you don't drink, or when you sleep or when you get up. Not from a spiritual point of view, he doesn't care about it. What he thinks is actually you should listen to your body. Let your body tell you what to do. After all, you're eating to help your body. Let your body tell you. Do what your body wants. You know. Never mind getting all your notions mixed up with the urges that rise. You know. Lao Tzu's emphasis is on something deeper than eating. And he would like to know, or he poses this so that you can ask yourself, do you go through life, all your day-to-day living, with such alertness and such an awareness as a person would do crossing an icy stream on a winter morning? Do you act like that day by day by day by day? This is what he emphasizes. Never mind what you eat. How alert are you? Is every act, well, we can sort of let that one go. How many acts of yours, how many acts of yours are performed in complete awakeness? By now, good students should have become aware of their inherent characteristics, by which is meant simply the tendencies you were born with. You should have a handshaking acquaintance with them by now. You've been around long enough. You know, we don't usually pay too much attention to the tendencies that rise in us. And, you know, so we don't face some of our problems because of this. Your tendencies are yours to cope with. It is what this world has given you, or rather, I should say, it is what the process has given you. We are in this process, you know. Your tendencies are these little things which you must work out. Very often they're opposed to what you think. So one should become aware of one's tendencies, one's inherent characteristics on which we build so much, instead of trying to run from them, or in trying to shun them, or in trying to repress them, because they maybe don't fit an idea we have about this image of ourselves. What one should do is sort of hang them on a line and deal. Just deal with them. One should become so aware of oneself that you can see these tendencies as they arise. Then you may go through a transformation. And when you go through this transformation, it doesn't matter what you eat. What becomes important then, are you eating in a state of awareness? Are you aware of every act? Are you aware of every taste? Are you aware of what you see? Are you aware of what you hear while you are sitting there waiting? You're just a state of alertness. The awareness of eating is more important than what you eat. Now, of course, I'm speaking from a spiritual point of view or a religious point of view or however you want to call it. If you're speaking from a health point of view, that's something else again. You may be able to tolerate this and you may not be able to tolerate that and so on. But whatever it is that you eat, you should be aware of the act of eating. Yeah. Now, we here in this Western culture, we have been brought up with the idea, do not sin. And the church catechism says, you know, and the little children learn it, they repeat it over and over again, you know, we are born in sin. We are born in sin. And it is the sin in which we are born, that we must overcome if we are to be saved, or if we are to see the kingdom. And this is sort of in here in our background of religion, of Christianity, particularly of the Roman Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Episcopalian Church, particularly the High Episcopalian, Low Episcopalian. Anyway, we are brought up to wrestle with this idea of sin. Adam fell from grace, and we're struggling still with his sin. Even though he lived 900 and something odd years, he still couldn't cope with it. And I understand that the latter part, you know, he had all these children, and they're all gathered around when he's dying, and the last part of them he doesn't even know, and they don't even believe him anymore that he ever lived in the garden. So it says somewhere. Now, if we could have been taught, I think, that Adam and Eve ate of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and that thusly they saw they were naked, and they put on fig leaves, and they realized what they were seeing now was phenomenal reality. I mean, if everybody could have realized that right from the beginning, it could have saved a lot of lives. It could have saved the Inquisition and the Christian Crusades and so on and so on. And that we understand out of that also that it is up to each one of the children of Adam and Eve. They're all the sons and the daughters. To get back into that garden and eat of the fruit of the tree of life. Why call the whole thing a sin? So anyway, but we've got it, and Christianity as a whole is struggling with this situation, this notion that we are sinners and that we must be saved. And what happens, you know, in some of the cases is that people, you know, they leap as if they were leaping into heaven. And they say then that the Christ will save us, will save me. How about if they didn't jump anywhere, but they stayed right where they were, looking at what I am, and what I am, and looking and looking and looking, until maybe the Christ did awaken within. And when he does wake up, then the whole situation has changed. The entire situation has changed. It's transformed. And this thing is not just an emotion in the psyche. It's not an emotional thing. It is an event. It is something that actually happens. And the Old Testament was written in the Aramaic, and most of the New Testament was written in Greek. And they call it Testament. Meaning that one testifies to the truth, so that these people who wrote these books of the Bible are testifying that this is the truth, that one stands as a witness before God and swears to God, I testify that this is the truth. And it is very interesting. And in some esoteric circles, they talk about it, that the word testify and the word testicle come from the same root. That a man swears by his manhood. Women didn't count in those days. You know, they were lucky that they could sit on the second floor with things over their head so that nobody knew they were there. One swears. Witness to God with one's very creative force. And this Greek testament says of sin, it doesn't use the word, it says miss the mark. So whatever I do, in this awareness of doing, is an act of virtue. Non-awareness is missing the mark. When Lao Tzu describes a holy man, he uses the word holy man rather than saint. His first descriptive word is alertness. A holy man is alert. A holy man is awake. A holy man no longer imbibes only in the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. He knows something about the garden. What about this garden? Let's not ignore the garden. And there in this garden are two trees. One is the tree of the good and evil, the knowledge thereof, and the other one is the knowing of life. And they are in the garden. And a man who is alert is like a man who has to cross an icy stream in the winter. And you and I know, or I think you know, or maybe you tried it, I tried it, not lately. You don't just romp across an icy stream. You walk very carefully, preferably from stone to stone, so you can stay out of the water. Anyway, he switches from just ordinary to this alertness. So it is now on quality. One acts with quality. The emphasis is on quality and not on the action. The emphasis then is this inherent wisdom and not the outer behavior. If you act out of this inner wisdom, your behavior is going to be fine. You don't have to worry about behavior. We usually have the cart before the horse. You know, we all cross it. You know, there is an icy stream, but depending on how we are is how we're going to cross it. Different ways. You know, there's some people that'll, you know, whistle all the way around, you know, through the whole thing, take his mind off the cold. Whistle. Another one goes creeping across, you know, takes him hours to get there, so he won't get his feet very wet. Another one just shoom and runs through it, to get it out of the way. Now, regardless of how you cross this river, what is incumbent upon us, each of us, the act of crossing is secondary. It is the quality of alertness that is incumbent upon us. And you can equate this icy stream with your life. How do you live your life? And now to have this inner vigilance, and you know that it's always there, it's just that you ignore it. You cover it over with something else. It is always there. It is an inner quality. We call it an inner happening or an inner perception or whatever. By the actions, of course, that all pertains to the personality and what goes on out there. It pertains to the conditioning that we have had, and it has to do with the tendencies that we are born with. So all of this we should be very aware of. Because you act according to what? How do you act? Why do you act how you act? You know, two holy men, two holy people, let us say, are walking down the street, and they do not act alike at all. They can't. It's an impossibility. Each of them acts according to his or her personality, which is the tendencies, the characteristics, the conditioning, etc. But the inner quality of being awake, of being aware, even if there were 1,000 holy men walking down the street, the awakeness in all of them is the same. Two idiots can behave the same. Their inner wakefulness is not the same. We could also say, now the movements of a battalion of soldiers, and they're all marching uniform, you know, as they do, which I really love to see. I mean, it's, you know, like from West Point or from the Naval Academy or something, and they march, you know, a little different than they march in Europe. I watched the soldiers from Russia yesterday marching. They march the same way as they do in Germany, you know. But we walk differently. We march. And they're all coming down and running, and whoop, you know, somebody yells something, and they all turn to the right, all one time, you know. And, you know, it's really something. And all these men, you know, marching like they're one man. And then they're ordered to turn left, and they all turn left. A soldier's actions in this marching thing has got to be uniform with all the rest of the troop, so much so that he loses all individuality in that instance. It is a group action. And if that entire group, that whole battalion, were awake, it would be one man. Incredible, huh? the inner hmm? One man moving left, one man moving right. Huh? You know, it's, where do we have it in there somewhere? The Wisdom of God by, the little book by somebody in India. I am in you and you are in me. We are one. Now to be aware of that, you could be aware of being in me. You could be aware of my every sensation. You could know how my skin felt when the breeze caressed it. How the thinking process would affect my body. Very interesting phenomena, that. Everybody the same. Me and you and you and me. So anyway, here's those two holy men walking down the street. They do not act alike. There's a story about that two men on Mount Athos. One is fat and one is skinny, and they act accordingly. You want to be. But in these two holy men, one fat and one thin, and they're acting accordingly, you know, the inner alertness is the same if they are awake. Because after all, awake is awake, huh? Awake is awake. Then, of course, you should be asking yourself, well, what is it in me that wakens? What is awake? What wakes up? Anyway, holy men are known by alertness, and us ordinary folks are recognized by our actions. Right? We look to the action. We look to the act to judge somebody else. We do indeed. You know, we say right away, oh, that's not the way I would do it at all. Mm-mm. They're doing it wrong. And we do recognize others by their actions. We do. So watch. And when somebody acts differently than what you expected or than how you would act, you don't have to have all that confusion. You know, you don't know what to think about them anymore. Everything begins to go around inside. You know, we don't know how to react. Just let them be. Let them do their way. And maybe we can get out of this thing of recognizing people by their actions. And we do that because this is how we think. We think people recognize me by how I act. So right away we say, see how good I am. And we act as if we were very, very good. Little girls and little boys. You know? See how thoughtful I am. See how well I do this. See how well I can ignore over there. See how well. See how good. See how kind. See how thoughtful. I am such a good little girl. See what I do? Yeah. And naturally, most of course, a holy man should act the way I expect him to act. Right? Like me. Exactly. Precisely, huh? Human beings, other human beings should act just like I do because I'm a human being, and if they're human beings, that's the way they should act. Now, this is Aristotle's law. That's the third law of the excluded middle of how we act. Everybody in the same boat. We forget that we do not all think alike, and we have different concepts regarding behavior and a lot of other things. If I were born in India, Krishna's actions, how what he did, his notions, you know, or the stories of his actions, you know, and all that, would govern me and my actions. I would try to act as much like Krishna, these stories about Krishna and how he acted, as I could, you know. If I am born in the West, the stories of the actions of Jesus govern me and my actions. Or they're supposed to. You know, the religion sets up the parameters, the basic rules, which I am to address to be free of sin. I'd like to say I'm of the fundamental persuasion. Then this Krishna business and the Buddha business and the mystic business and all this stuff doesn't fit into my concepts at all, and so it's all just no good. You shouldn't even look at it. You shouldn't listen to it at all. See, I have my little box of limitations, and we're proud of them. You know, it's like Jack used to say, we wear our stupidity like a badge of honor. And our limitations, you know, they sort of go along like this. There is a sect in Jains over in India, and they do not wear clothes. They have renounced them. Some people renounce sex, and some people renounce milk, and some people renounce meat, and some people renounce the world, but they renounce their clothes. Mahavira was a holy man and was their founder, and he didn't wear clothes. So the adherents to his presentation, they do not wear clothes either. Actually, in the Jain sect, there are two groups. One wears clothes and the other one doesn't, and they do not wear clothes. They're following their leader. The leader's actions govern theirs, governs their thinking, and thereby it governs their actions, right? And of course, in this world, if you look at it like that, it's very logical. And then they say, well, now you look at the Buddha. He wears clothes. He's not quite as holy as Mahavira, right? He has not yet renounced clothes. And then the Christians say, well, if you're going to look, at least look at the Christ. Look what he renounced. He sacrificed himself for the sake of the world. What did Mahavira sacrifice? Clothes? What's that? You know? And Buddha didn't sacrifice anything. Well, yes, he did. He sacrificed his palace and his life as a king. Well, but what's that? You know, Mahavira is a very selfish man. He meditated for himself. He sought liberation for himself. And so did the Buddha. He left everything so he could become enlightened. But the Christ was different. He gave up his life for mankind. He suffered himself to be hung on a cross. And Mahavira and the Buddha served nobody but themselves, and the Christ served everybody. And the other two are just in a very deep selfishness. And he who is not rid of his selfishness, how can he get rid of his ego? Then the Jains would come back and say, the cross was his karma. Yeah, that was the result of some past actions. That's why. Look at Mahavira. Even when he picked a rose, the thorn did not dare to prick him. Never, it just laid down. And he could walk through the grass, you know, with all the weeds and the stickers and everything else. Not one of them touched him. No. See, we're a very funny bunch, we people. Huh? We have all types of behavior, all types of conduct, and we have all kinds of thinking into which we have been molded. And we have then furthered on our own. And all of us, knowingly or unknowingly, pattern our lives around some holy man, around some holy person. We do. Somewhere along the line, the stories around which we have molded ourselves, we have to give up. We have to give up the story for the real. You know, I say it to you so often, you must be able to ignore your concepts in order to be free. Difficult, very difficult. We are so identified with our thinking, and we're so entrapped by it. And it's, you know, talk about sticky fingers. Also, you see, there's the concepts that you acknowledge that you have. What about the ones that you do not know you have? They're there, too. And sometimes when I point one out to you, golly gee, the reaction, out the door and slam it. And then a couple of weeks later, you come back again. Well, I guess she was right. Very begrudgingly. Do you, I mean, what kind of notion do you have about this real self? Do you think that the real self of you has got this elaborate concept of karma? Or have you ever thought about it? It's sitting in there somewhere in you. Haven't thought about it, bring it up and look at it. Yeah? What about this real self? What about its theory of reincarnation? How deep do you think this real self has thought about it? Does this real self of you have any idea how great you are? Does it have any idea of how hard you are working to recognize this self? Does this true self of yours say to you, you know, my dear, you are trying so hard, why do you not rest for a moment? Do you think any of this is going on? Or maybe you do. The real self has no concepts, period. And the trouble we have, you see, is because we're trying to bring along all this baggage, all of our good thoughts, because we'll leave the bad ones behind, but all our good thoughts we want to take with us. And so the self and you cannot meet, because it doesn't think, and here you want it to think all the things that you think are so nice. You're trying to load it up with your baggage. It isn't going to work. One must, at times, especially when one is sitting, ignore the thinking. Just ignore the thinking. You will be in an exquisitely beautiful world. You will penetrate into it if you will just drop your luggage. You'll pick it up again, don't worry. You won't like it when you pick it up, but you know, it's okay. You know. Now, this inner alertness is a very valuable asset. And understand this well. It is a very valuable asset. A great deal of your future depends on it. Our way of thinking, our way of living, our responses, our reactions depend on how alert we are. What is important in your life and what is important in my life is within, the inner alertness. What is out there are shadows of what is in here. Shadows. Now, Lao Tzu says, the holy man vacillates. Well, that's not our idea of a holy man at all. At all. He vacillates like one fearing danger all around. from the four quarters of all the neighbors, he says. Huh? Now, we think that a holy man should be very strong of purpose and to be very rigid, never vacillating. So this he vacillates is very difficult for us to understand. He is no longer then true and tried and all the rest of the Boy Scouts things, huh? Now, a man may say, I promise, I will never tell a lie again. Comes New Year's Eve, you know, he's doing this like crazy. But sometimes during the year, he also feels the need of it, you know. I promise never to lie again. To whom does he make that promise? To whom does he make that resolution? And it's made with such stringent rigidity, because this is how you must make a resolution. And so you think if a man is very holy, he also is this stringent rigidity. Huh? Now this man who lies, he knows that the liar inside of himself is stronger than he is. Otherwise he wouldn't lie. Huh? If he's not stern and rigid, he will lie. Quite naturally. Huh? So he vows strongly. And of course he lies again. I mean, that is his nature. Better he look to see where this thing comes from and correct it there than you know, holding this defense up against it. Because every time he takes a vow or promises, makes this resolution, he's not going to lie, and he breaks that, then he's guilty. And the guilt grows, and the guilt grows. And the more vows he breaks, the more guilt. Against whom has he brought up all these defenses? Now, if he could vacillate, if he could move easily from this side to this side, and this side to this side, you know, he would have no need for vows. If this liar came up, he'd just step aside and let the liar go right past. Yeah, to let it go by. You know, this vacillation, you know, it's a thing that I used to wonder about. I walked down the street with Dr. Plato. And I wonder, what's he afraid of? Why, he's looking for danger everywhere. You know, hardly cross the street. You know, and he'd hang on to me crossing the street. And, you know, and it's like the buildings were going to fall down. And sometimes when he walked down the street with him, so everything would shake, you know, like every, he was, you know, I realized he was doing this. But anyway, you know, he expected things to come down. So, what's he afraid of? Very difficult for me to understand at the time. And because, you know, just the opposite is true. He's very strong and he's fearless. He's not afraid of anybody. And I've seen him in action there too. He isn't. They vacillate. Interesting, huh? Not at all our notions. Not at all. So you get rid of the notions, you know. We make vows, you know, that with whoever is wherever, whoever you make your vows to, you know, to whomever you are testifying, huh? Against that which is hidden in us, in a way, yeah. So we say, I vow, I will never, ever be angry again. I'm never going to get angry again. Well, what does this tell me? Somewhere in here, there's some anger that I don't know about because it comes up too easily. And then, so it's hiding. So I better jolly well, you know, get on the stick here and then look and see what's going on in here. So, and then there are people who say, they take a vow of celibacy. Why? You know, so you ask yourself, what kind of a crazy notion am I hiding? Yeah. What am I suppressing? Let us say that a holy man is against violence. You think he gets up every morning and vows to practice nonviolence? Every morning. Today I vow I will practice nonviolence. No. Just automatically a part of him. Like kindness is automatically a part of him. We look around and every once in a while we say, well, this is very lacking in me. I vow from now on I will be kind and courteous. Why do I have to make this kind of a vow? Am I not already kind? Well, I guess I'm not. And I vow to have more patience. Okay, so I've not got patience then, And I vow to be more courteous. Am I not just naturally courteous? If I'm not just naturally courteous and kind and etc., etc., my vows are not going to help me. What one already is, one does not have to practice. And one does not have to make promises and does not have to make vows. If you are in a situation that calls for vowing, look very deeply and keep on looking and keep on looking. The kindness of Dr. Planoff in all his stringency, some of it's terrible. Poor Bob went through all kinds of things with him. Oh, how he used to yell at Bob. Oh, my. He didn't yell at me that much, But how? Then when it's all said and done, you think how, my God, with tremendous kindness, because through that I saw something. I saw something. Does he think he's kind? No way. Does he think he's patient? No way. He doesn't think about it. See? So and with all this stuff, we're going to have in the future. I mean, today we make a big boo-boo, and we're very embarrassed with it. So we vow we're not ever going to do this again. I caught myself doing that once when I was about 18. And I looked at that and I thought, you darn fool, you're going to go right out and do that thing again. So what's the point of this? Let us not decide today how we will live tomorrow. When tomorrow is today, then I will know what to do. Each step I take will be self-deciding. It will decide itself. People by the millions in this world belong to what we call fundamental religion, which is simply that the Bible is to be taken literally. And that's fine. There is a place for everyone, and we are all in a different place. And they sort of have this idea that God is watching to be sure that they follow his word. It's a very easy way to go. It's a very easy way to go. Because I do not have to go through this long, difficult chore of seeking to find out if God is or if God is not. And if he is not, then what is? And if he is, what is he like? I don't have to worry about that at all. Look at a lot of time saving it is. If I have no need to seek, I have no need to be alert. And if I do not have to be alert, I can just slough my way through life, making vows. Easy. Easy come, easy go. That's your life? I'll tell you, the path of inquiry, this inquiring mind, and this force behind the inquiring mind, why is this this way? What is this in actuality? This inquiry that we put forth, takes energy, and it takes hard work. It's a chore. Somebody, I've forgotten quite who, said in some interview, We have, every one of us, an inquiring force. And of course we do, we all have it. But what do you do with it? Do you look from the little slit of a window in your ivory tower and say, oh, it's dark out there and it's unknown, so I think I will just stay here? Without your being aware of it, you have already made a little inquiry. Look, it's unknown. See, this unknown already is a question in you. The inquiring mind. And we should deal with this inquiry and not just set it aside. So it's unknown. We should say, let it be. It's unknown. Just let it be. Don't do that. Go for it. You know, like they said in the Olympics last, whenever they had them, you know, go for the gold. Do it. Huh? But you know, it also recognized right at the beginning, when you start out on this inquiry, or whatever inquiry, it takes courage. And there is a price to pay. Everything has a price. See? All the happiness that you've been chasing, you've been pursuing happiness, you know, has cost you your years. Can't you find something better to do than just chase your ego? That's what you're doing, chasing happiness. Use that inquiring mind. Use it. You know, we're really very protected. Animals, they roam through the fields and all that wilderness. They don't think this, but we think it for them. They never know if they're going to live out the day. They forage for food and shelter every day, every day. You don't have to do that. We have houses. We're protected. We know whereabouts we're at. Yeah, we think. See? And the extra money that we have, we keep it in the bank so it's more secure. And we worry about security. Security has become a big thing with us. I don't feel secure with you. I feel rejected with you. And I feel secure with you so you can be my friend. This security thing is, you know, all out of proportion almost. You know, it's a very different thing than with the animal. A wild animal is always on the brink of death. Always. And so it is very alert. And it listens. See? We are not alert and we don't listen. We live in the same house for weeks and months and years. Who needs to listen to what's going on? I mean, you know, the Tibetans, they send their would-be lamas to the cemetery. And here they find this newly dug grave in this cemetery. And they have to lie in this grave for 3 days. And there's wild animals roaming around, the dogs that eat the dead, you know, down to the bones, and hyenas and stuff like that, they're running around. And they're looking for food. The Jesuits practice the coffin exercise. They lie in a coffin for 3 days as if they were dead, which of course has come to us through the ancient Greek mysteries, which came to the Greeks through the Egyptian mysteries. Buddha sent his bhikshus to the cremation ground. And he said, you must come to know death while you're still alive.
If you find Lola's talks
only
valuable,
then will you be alive.
More will be posted in weeks to come.
See, so there's one of them who's quite a scholar, and he says, why? Why should I go there? You're here. Why should I go there? I will sit and meditate here with you. Buddha sent him away. He says, if you stay near me, you will not know death. What's there to be afraid of if you're always under the shadow of the Buddha? Of course, we should remember that. because we are always under the shadow of the Buddha nature. When you use that approach. Yeah. And he says, go and see death standing by your side. And the day that you do that, you will find me also. The real Buddha. So Lao Tzu, the holy man, has his life, and it is as a profound performance. He is a guest in this world. And of course, this has to do with identification. Not being identified with the contents of the psyche, that there's this gap in between, this attachment is no longer there. He places himself where he needs to be at the moment to act how he needs to act. And then he withdraws again when the need is over. Can you do that? Mm-hmm. And they are unpretentious. They are like wood that has not yet been carved. A holy man makes no claim for himself. He is not yet formed into a chair or a table or an idol. An uncarved piece of wood that can become anything. So he places himself and becomes that. He withdraws and places himself. Unproclaimed, vacant like a valley, they do not make themselves prominent. A valley is deep. It's hidden, and we look at it down there and say, oh, how dull. It is dull like muddy water, says Lao Tzu. Vacant like a valley and dull as muddy water. No claim for saintliness. No broadcasting, I have had such and such an experience. Bulwer Lytton wrote a book called Zanoni, and it is the story of a young master and an old master, one who had been a master a long, long time and who had conquered many things. And the young master is just enlightened, and all the difficulties that he gets into, because he now knows, so he rushes into this and he rushes into that and he rushes in. And the old master is forever getting him out again, and training him so he can grow up a little. So we say that's young. And there is, once upon a time there was an emperor, and he read all of this by Lao Tzu, and he wanted a teacher, so he set out in search for a holy man. And he wanted a holy man, as vacant as a valley, and dull like muddy water. You know. So he traveled. He went to temples, he went to churches, and he'd come back, and then he'd start out again, and he'd go to temples, and he'd go to churches, and wherever he thought, you know, they might be, all he met were mountain peaks. Standing up there, you know. No valleys. Finally, from one of his trips, he's coming back again. He again went through the gates of the city, and there was a beggar that stopped him. And he said to this emperor, I have seen you coming and going many, many times. What is it you seek? And the emperor replied, I am in search of a holy man who is deep and empty, as Lao Tzu described. And the beggar laughed at him. He says, go on your way. And the emperor turned around and looked at him. He says, what do you mean? You asked me what I was doing, and now you say, go away. And the king stood there and looked at him, and he was very puzzled. And then he really looked at the man, you know? And he looked into his eyes, and there it was. They were a deep, deep emptiness. And the beggar had let it slip for a moment. And he said to the king, please don't tell anybody. You know, as a beggar I can hide. Don't tell anybody. of course, the emperor got home and he told everybody. You know. And the next day, the whole court went down to see this beggar. And he was gone.
If you find Lola's talks valuable, more will be posted in weeks to come.